to day five. I can't believe how quickly this week has gone by. My name is Carla Sumla. I teach at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. And this week we've been taking a look at religious pluralism in America and using a case study approach. I just want to thank you all for working with me on this. These case studies are fairly new, and I've been working with the editor at the Pluralism Project. It's number three. Her name is Ellie Pierce at Harvard, and she released some of these case studies to me to be able to use here. And based on this week, I'm going to do a little bit of write-up and talk about how it went, the kinds of reactions, the setting here, that sort of thing, because they're looking for any sort of feedback. That was sort of the deal. She said, you can have them, you just tell me how it went, what works, you know, what you'd like to see more of. So it was my first time working through these case studies. It was actually really powerful for me to be able to use case studies in a teaching setting. I haven't done that before in the courses that I typically teach. Introduction to Bible, Introduction to the Hebrew Bible, Judaism. I haven't done quite as much of that, and now I'm really, really inspired to do a whole lot more. I'm on sabbatical for this coming year, and one of the things that I'm have said as one of my goals is to work out a course to bring back to Luther for students on interreligious dialogue and thinking about the best ways of teaching this sort of thing. The courses that I've looked at that other people have taught are really theory heavy. So you read about what dialogue is and try to understand, which I think is certainly important, and we're going to do more theory today. But my thought is, after especially doing it this week at Holden, that case studies are really a powerful way to engage people in the actual working through the situations. And so I just wish there were more of them. And I guess anytime I say I wish there were more of them, that means probably I'm going to have to write them. It's kind of how it works out. When you don't have the resources, you just have to make them yourself. So I've been thinking a little bit about that. At any rate, here are some of the resources that I've drawn upon this week in particular. There are many, many, many more. But I want to, again, point to this text. Diana Eck, then this book is new to me, so I've been working through it as I've been sharing it with you. Encountering God, A Spiritual Journey from Bozeman to Benares. And the second edition is particularly great because it's updated, 2003. It first came out in 1993, in some ways celebrating the 100th anniversary of the World's Parliament of Religions in Chicago. And then it was released again 6 years ago. The film that we took a look at the beginning of the week with clips, Divided We Fall, Americans in the Aftermath. This is 2008. It's a New Moon Productions. You can buy it on Amazon, which is where I got it before I came. It's reasonably priced. Right? The Pluralism Project is a great resource if you're looking for further reading materials. I was telling these folks here that they have a really great resource where they keep a list of articles that are coming in, like on a weekly basis, of issues of religious pluralism, particularly in the United States. And they have links to those newspaper articles, news reports, that sort of thing. And those in and of themselves are great conversation pieces. They also have bibliographies, they've got events, they've got a lot of different things. They another page on films that are good in educational settings and for discussion settings. Another one that is just recently released is called Fremont, USA, Fremont, California. And it has some parallels to the one that we looked at, but it looks more at that one particular community and the religious pluralism and the interaction that happened there. It sounds like a really, really interesting film. I didn't get a chance to preview it before we came, but I'm going to do it as soon as I get a chance. Finally, this book, Covenantal Conversations, I think particularly interesting for Lutherans, is a book that the Lutheran Jewish Consultative Panel for the ELCA has just recently published. So this is a group that I've been a part of for 7 years now. I've got two chapters in that text, and so do some of my other colleagues who are Lutheran. It's an interesting book in that Lutherans were writing these chapters, all right, what are the kinds of the benchmarks, what are the issues or challenges or hopes or dreams for Jewish-Christian interaction? And so it's divided into 8 chapters, and then at the end of each chapter, we were each in conversation with a Jewish scholar or rabbi. So there's somebody then who's commenting on what we've done, adding to it, that sort of thing. So it is really a conversational sort of text. In addition, Augsburg Fortress has also published a study guide to go along with this. So it works really well. And this book does not have to be read in its entirety. You can take out units that are particularly interesting. The chapters that I worked on in this are 1, the land of Israel. What is so significant about the land in Jewish history, thought, theology, culture, that sort of thing, the land of Israel. And I do a historical overview. The other chapter that I did is called Tikkun Olam, Repairing the World. And I put that concept in conversation with Luther's idea of vocation. And so kind of making Luther and the Jewish rabbis conversation partners about what it means to be citizens of the world. Right? How do we live in this world that we have inherited? And so, but there are many more. There is a case study at the end on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. There are all kinds of different sorts of things. A chapter on, are there irreconcilable differences between Jews and Christians? Or another one called Tough Texts. Some of those texts that I mentioned in yesterday's session, in the Gospels and the New Testament. How do we preach those texts? How do we think about those texts? So that, I think, is kind of an interesting sort of good first step in interreligious dialogue that where Lutherans can kind of get a foothold. Yeah?
Where's a good place to pick that up?
You can, Augsburg Fortress, so you can go directly to their website or Amazon, depending on what. But Augsburg Fortress, and I can even put in a plug for them, their prices are reasonable and their shipping has become, they have really transformed over the last couple of years. They will get it to you as fast as Amazon will. Yeah. So use them. They're a good organization. Any other questions about resources before we get moving? All right. Go back to the beginning here. Let's see. Today, like I said, we're going to do a little bit of theory to get us launched and kind of bringing in a little bit more conversation about what do we do now. We've looked at all these different cases. We've been able to see, as I talked to people in conversations afterwards, as we were able to kind of pull apart these case studies and see the different issues, we were able to see the complexity involved. Somebody mentioned to me, they said, but you didn't give us any answers. My students say the same thing. In interreligious dialogue, there is no key at the end of the book. There are no answers at the end that you can take a look at. There are some guidelines. There are definitely things that we can think about. But I think, especially this week when I've been talking to Jody Kretzman and some of his situations, a lot of interreligious dialogue has to begin with real people in local situations as opposed to theory. All right? And the best possible setting is people who are thoughtful, who come together to try to interact and engage with each other, all right, and bring in these sorts of things. So we'll take a look at some of the terms that I've been throwing around this week, pluralism, diversity, plurality, all those different sorts of things. They can mean widely different things. Martin Luther King Jr. in the 60s, in one of his speeches, already had said, we live in a world house. In one of the speeches he was giving, he says, it's as if a widely separated family inherits a house in which they have to live together. This is the great new problem of mankind. We have inherited a large house, a great world house, in which we have to live together. Black and white, Easterner and Westerner, Gentile and Jew, Catholic and Protestant, Muslim and Hindu. A family unduly separated in ideas of culture, and interest, who, because we can never again live apart, must somehow learn to live with each other in peace. So I love this household image, this image of this great house in which we have to live together. We do live together. How we do this is the question. We're already doing it. The how is the next piece. And I think household is really a great image, particularly for Christians in examining this, because household is such a powerful image in our sacred texts. All right, living in the household of God, body is another image. Paul uses it a lot. We are all members of one body, so body and household. Those are images that Christians already have as part of their religious vocabulary and worldview. Right? And so it's not placing something foreign on top of that. In interreligious dialogue, what we took a look at, I provided some definitions, a wide variety of definitions for interreligious dialogue, because it's changed so much over the last 100 years, our first century of interreligious dialogue. The first part of these definitions I call the foundation of the house, all right? Some of the bottom line. Avoid violence. That was our first case study. We had a murder of a Sikh. How can we avoid harm, hurt, violence, death, all right? So you kind of, you know, when you're doing triage, what are the problems out there? This is one of the first sorts of issues that emerges. Curb hate. All of these pieces are always linked together. All right. If there's going to be violence, there's usually hate. All right. How can we curb some of the hate that's out there? Hate does not make for thriving individuals or communities. How can we reduce prejudice, stereotyping, and ignorance? So all of, like I said, they all kind of feed into each other. If we've got strong prejudice or stereotypes, or we're ignorant about the other, we're more likely to hate. If we're more likely to hate, who knows where that will lead? Encourage tolerance. This is sort of the neutral position. Live and let live, okay? And it's not like you're thinking that much about the other, but you're not out to kill them, which is good. You're not actively hating, and you're not out there spreading prejudice, stereotypes, that sort of thing. It's just sort of, they're there, I'm here, let's just be. Of a neutral position. This has been sort of the position, you hear this word tolerance a lot. In the dialogue circles and in where pluralism is talked about, this tolerance is certainly not a bad thing, but it shouldn't be the end point in these sorts of things. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move along. So that's the foundation of the house. In some ways, curbing negative sorts of things, maybe getting to a neutral place. That's, you know, we've got to have those in place before we can build the house, all right, or build it up again. So what does the house look like? All right, finding common ground. I said that this is one of the areas in dialogue that really emerged after World War II. Religious folks getting together saying, what do we have in common? Whether it was in practices or beliefs or perspectives, all right, what can we agree on, or what do we do that's similar? All right, and that sort of thing. So it's common ground, seeking common ground. After that, common goals. What can we work toward together in terms of our communities, whether they be religious communities, social networks, economic issues? What can we come together on to work toward particularly and concrete goals? Now, this is one of the places where many, many Americans are now getting involved in dialogue. Synagogues and churches getting together to have food pantries or soup kitchens. Mosques and churches doing those sorts of things. Other religious groups connecting with each other. Neighborhood watch. How can we keep our neighborhood safe for all of our kids? And so people kind of getting together to do that. Common political goals. Different groups getting together. Sometimes it's more problematic. We see interesting coalitions emerging around social or political or religious goals. In California recently, there was a coalition between Mormons and Catholics who normally wouldn't get along, on opposing gay marriage. All right? So these coalitions can go in all kinds of directions, but they were a coalition. Groups that before had very little to do with each other, but they realized they had a common cause, and so they pooled the resources. Right? And so this can happen in all kinds of different directions. From there, building relationships with each other. So once we've kind of maybe found some common ground, we've worked together for something we both believe in, we find that we kind of like each other. We're friends. We've talked about our kids. We've talked about our ups and downs. We've compared notes on our teenage sons. And we've encouraged each other, saying, yes, there is hope. We're trying to get, we're working on these different sorts of things. We compare, all kinds of different things, whether it's our grandchildren or taking care of aging parents, and we're both in the same boat. We find that we've got a lot in common in our lives, in the very texture of what we do every day. We talk about how hard it is to juggle everything, how to get everything done, how busy life seems, right? And we found, wow, they've got like the same problems that I do, right? So you kind of find that you have, and once you're friends, you've realized that, just like any friend, you start seeing beyond the difference in terms of relying on that person. With relationship also comes trust. I can tell this person things. I can rely on them. Can you pick up my kid after school today? I've got a dentist appointment. And from little things to much bigger things. We go on to deepening knowledge and understanding. I say deepen here because in order to sort of reduce prejudice and intolerance and stereotypes, there's a basic level of education that needs that needs to be done in terms of correcting some of those. But after basic corrective knowledge, there's much more that is positive. How can our knowledge of the other and ourselves have more depth, right? And our understanding of ourselves and the other have more depth and meaning. Finally, mutual witness. This is what Diana Eck talked about. We witness to the other from our own perspective, our own tradition, and they witness to us. All right? They witness to us. And in all of this, what might come about is transformation. We might be changed. And if we've done all this, I should take away the word might. We will be changed. How will we be changed? We can't go into this saying, well, I'm willing to change here, 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 but the rest of it's off limits. We don't know how we'll be changed. That's the tricky part. That's the problem with change. We can't predict it. When we can predict it's going to happen, we just don't know what forms it's going to take. Right? So this transformation. So this is the range of pieces that go into dialogue. I've almost put them in an order saying they've got to go from here to here, but it doesn't necessarily have to always be that way. I think this is a spectrum, all right? And not everybody's going to kind of work through the steps sort of thing. I think people have different aspects of this depending on context and all those sorts of things, all right? But I just kind of wanted to put together where dialogue sort of started and kind of where it's going right now. We keep adding to the word, to the activity. All right? Why all this interreligious dialogue? Why are we doing this? The world, the United States in particular, is a plural reality. We live it. It's not should we anymore, or what do we think about it? It is us. Right? I included this picture on the bottom. I'll get to that. But the United States is probably the most diverse nation in the world, ethnically, religiously, culturally. All right, we've got a lot of difference represented around us. We live and we work and we attend school side by side. All right, and not only are we side by side, we have become neighbors, friends, and family. This is just a few weeks at the start of our summer journeys. David and I and the kids have been gone now since the beginning of July, and we started out at the lakes in Minnesota, where my parents have a summer place. And here's my mom, so here's Grandma, and here are her five grandchildren. Jacob and Stella are from my third sister. They're her and her husband's biological children. Jacob and Stella Sumala Melhoff. So that's a little bit of blending in traditions, German and Finnish. My mother is Finnish on both sides. Her parents and grandparents and everybody there spoke Finnish. They're, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, you kind of, so that German-Finnish connection's a little new, all right? Here are my kids, Dawit and Maharet, and they're from Ethiopia, all right? My husband's from Guatemala. He was born Jewish in Guatemala. So we've got a Finnish, Guatemalan, Jewish, Ethiopian household. And I think my son Dawit's name represents that most beautifully. Dawit, which is David or David in Amharic, the main Ethiopian language. Dawit Samuel, because 1st and 2nd Samuel, and I'm a biblical scholar, and I love that name. Dawit Samuel Vasquez Sumala. That's my dad. And he got a big ice cream cone when he learned how to spell his last name. Here's the newest addition to our family. This is Daniel Vasudevan Kumala. My brother and his wife combined their last names. So he's got, he's from India, Chennai, India. And he arrived in our family about a year and a half ago. So we're a diverse family. We didn't set out to become this way. This was not the plan that my parents put on the dinner table at night when we were kids and said, this is where we want you to go. This is what we want to happen. This is the family we ended up becoming, Grandma and her grandchildren. So that Maharet can say, my grandma loves me so much. You know, and they know that. And they know, you know, they have this sense. And they know that their cousins come in different colors. And they know that they have aunts and uncles that speak different languages. All right. This is America today. This is America. And so it's not, we are not a theory. So when, sometimes when people talk about pluralism, I say, it's not a theory, it's my life. So don't talk about whether it should or shouldn't happen, or what you happen to think about it. Because this is what we do every day. Our house, this great world house that we live in, is furnished by inters. We're interrelated. We are interconnected, interrelated, and interdependent in this world. It's not just that we live next to each other. We can't actually live without each other. All right? Whether we see each other or not. So my problem is also the problem of someone in Africa. My success is built upon the work of someone in Asia, whom I've never met. My failure may be due to the failure of someone in Latin America. Maybe a crop failed there, which has consequences for me, or a shipment didn't arrive, which has consequences for my business. My hope is also might be linked to the hope of someone in Europe. Right? So we're in all these realms. It's not as if it's a choice any longer. So living together in a world house, what are some of the responses to this idea of religious pluralism with these many others? And there are a couple. Diana Eck outlines three different responses that are out there right now. Okay, and the first one is exclusivism. So under this view, we have the sense that our community, our tradition, our understanding of reality, our encounter with God is the one and only truth, excluding all others. My God, I'm right. All right? So our God is not listening to the God of other faiths. My God listens to me because I'm praying correctly. The exclusivist identity is based on what they are not. Okay? What they are not. I'm not this. I'm not that. Okay? And in that process, the exclusivist attempts to clearly mark the boundaries between us and them. Exclusivists can be found in any religious tradition. Christians aren't, you know, primary owners of this. We happily share this with people around the globe. Exclusivism tends to be quite a strong tendency. There are all kinds of exclusivism. It can be religious exclusivism. It can be ethnic or racial exclusivism. It can be gender exclusivism. This is men only, women only. All right. So all kinds of exclusivism can be found out there, as well as religious. This is one response. So in response to the other, if you're an exclusivist, what might be some reactions to living side by side with someone who's religiously other, if you're a religious exclusivist? Yeah?
A feeling of superiority.
I'm better. I'm better. I know more. I've got something they don't. I'm better. Right? What might be some other reactions?
Maybe I can teach them.
Maybe I can teach them. Can they teach me? No.
Heck no.
Heck no. But I have something that, you know, to teach them. What might be some other reactions?
Maybe I don't want to have a relationship with them.
I don't want to have a relationship with them.
Might be afraid of them.
I'm afraid of them, because what if our kids start playing together? What if that the us and them gets a little bit blurry? What if it gets a little bit blurry? So there's some issues in terms of this living with very firmly by this view. What are some, why might people be attracted to this?
Safer?
Safety? Yeah. And in the United States, with the whole atmosphere, politics of fear, the us and the them, we breathe this us and them. Remember the axis of evil.
Give certainty.
Give certainty. I know. I am, and also not only certainty, I know I'm right. Again, with the axis of evil. They are evil, I am good.
It's like you don't have to think about your faith. The answers right. are there. Right. I know it, and this is the way.
You don't need challenge. There's no possibility for challenging it in terms of that sort of thing. But yeah, it gives you a sense of safety, a sense of security, other sorts of things.
Is it passive in any way?
In some way. What do you mean? Go further with that.
Well, if I don't have to deal with them, then I can avoid encounter. And that seems to me has been actually a problem within Lutherans, mm-hmm. a passive stream of Lutheranness, mm-hmm. that you don't deal with certain issues. That certainly contributed to Nazi Germany.
Right.
So to resist being active by engaging.
So I'm not going in my backyard building a 12-foot high fence saying keep out. I'm just not going to talk to them. I'm just not going to engage. Sort of, you know, not in, you know, I just don't do it sort of thing. Yeah, it can be passive. This is just the way it is.
Well, I think all of the engaging and all of it takes a lot more work. You know, it's easier to just not do anything than to actually go.
So that passive piece, sometimes it can be hard work to be an exclusivist if you need to keeping those boundaries up. I mean, and somebody else keeps trying to take the walls down and you've got to keep pounding them up. But a passive exclusivist, that might be heaven. You don't have to change. Nobody can challenge you.
And I don't know that it's hard. I mean, in the Pacific Northwest, I mean, my dad lives in this little town. It's not so little, but he lives in Olympia. And I don't think he intentionally is an exclusivist. But by default, he doesn't know people of different races, faiths, anything. He really never has. That kind of describes him, but I don't know that he's that intentional, you know?
So in some ways that's related but not identical to passive exclusivism,
yeah.
Partly because he hasn't had the opportunity or has not sought the opportunity. And again, there's the work part, to find others.
Yeah. And he thinks tolerance is a dirty word.
Oh, sorry.
That's all right. I think religion can be a scapegoat for some other issues sometimes. We can put our religion out there and say, my religion says this about... So
it can be sort of an ultimate authority. Since I'm right and my religion is right and it says this about, we don't need to keep talking about this. Yeah, we know plenty of situations from many religious stripes. Like I said, many world religious traditions have this.
It strikes me that it has an awful lot to do with our openness to learning.
Right.
Because if we're to be honest about it, real learning happens when we're open to only on the edge of discomfort, and we don't like to be uncomfortable.
Right. You know, or the learning is different. Much of the missionary movement before like the mid-20th century was very exclusivist. I have the truth, I'm bringing it to you, you don't have it, and I'm going to teach you about it. But many missionaries, it didn't mean they didn't learn. Many missionaries have been remarkable in their ability to learn languages, write them down, learn about cultures. But it's been the objective of all that learning. So it's kind of like, what do you do with the learning you have? You know?
What?
This has been taught as normative in most Christian churches.
Right.
People in my congregation over, I hate to do this, older than me, this would surprise them that we would have this conversation. And they've been taught that our job is to go save those infidels. Right. I don't mean that in a negative way.
No.
It's just that's what we've always been taught. You know, Jesus is the one way to God, and we got to help those people.
So the new, right. So it's a warm, fuzzy feeling towards the infidel. We really need to go out there to get those infidels.
We don't know any better.
We don't know any better.
Gives us something to do. I think of hymns like "Onward, Christian Soldier."
Yeah.
How uncomfortable that makes me feel now. I mean, we should not be out there singing anything that, first of all, it has to do with war, in my opinion. But the message of that is just so.
You know, that hymns like that kind of foster that sort of thing that are just part of the fabric. I remember Vacation Bible School when I was a kid, and we got to take turns with the flag. And somebody would carry the Bible, and somebody would carry the flag, and you'd be the line leaders, and all the other 90 little kids would follow you, and we'd march into the sanctuary. Onward, Christian. Like, oh my gosh. And I'm like, we were marching little children talking about... Yeah, but it's part of it.
One of the scary things about all this is that it betrays a substantial amount of ignorance of our own church history.
Right.
The problem, the easiest place to see this, I'm sure it shows up in a lot of theology as well, as in a hymn book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because as proud as we might be of our Norwegian and German general Scandinavian heritage, an awful lot of our hymns come out of the English hymn tradition. And they even let me, a Scotsman, in the church, so...
Okay.
Well, how about a mighty fortress?
A mighty fortress is right. It's like keeping them out.
Right.
So we're marching to war, we're keeping them out, we're, you know, all those sorts of things. Yeah, this exclusive might just be default. All right? Interestingly enough, like I had mentioned, it can be all these different sorts of things. The next possibility is inclusivism. Right. Interestingly, Diana Saek says that most American Christians probably fall into this category. They're closer to this, based on some of the trends and the way people vote and the way they self-describe. All right. There are many communities, traditions, and truths, according to the inclusivist, but our own way of seeing things is the culmination of the others. All right. Superior to the others. Or at least wide enough to include others in our own terms. All right? So I've got the best way, but the Christian message is open to everyone, and, you know, we can talk to each other so that, but there, it's an interesting sense, but everything is defined by my terms. So when I talk to somebody, I would even use my categories. If I'm a Christian talking to somebody of another tradition, I'd go and like, okay, what do you believe about God? Do you have a triune God? And so I'm already using my categories. I'm not, and they're saying, well, what do you mean, triune? Three? You know, that we're using our categories, our ways of looking at things, as sort of the normative, standard, correct way of thinking about religion, thinking about God. So our God is listening, but it is our God as we understand this God who does the listening, okay? So we get to define who God is in the inclusivist sense. So yeah, everybody's praying to God, but they're praying to my God. They just don't know it.
Yeah.
That's kind of how this works. They're praying to my God, they just don't know it yet, okay? Most American Christians, probably inclusivists, they see the message of Christ or Christianity as open to everyone, right. Plurality is different than pluralism. This term plurality is closer to diversity. Just simply an adjective to describe. So many difference, much difference, is not necessarily viewed as a threat, and others aren't always viewed as opponents. So it's not always us. It can be, but it doesn't automatically jump to that. The borders aren't quite as firm for the inclusivist. This is kind of what an inclusivist perspective might be hiding, or it may be explicit. Your religion is fine, but mine is the best. Right? So as opposed to your religion is wrong, yours is fine, and if you think a little bit more about it, you'll come around to my view eventually. This is very much the view at the World Parliament of Religions. That what?
Some of our church members were invited to a local mosque. We've mm-hmm. been doing these we had the whole event, and then they invited us to come. And so at one point they were talking, and the interpretation, I realized what the imam had just said was that yes, we can, you know, we believe Jesus, he's one of the prophets. Ours is just an evolution of that.
Right,
faith
has evolved beyond that.
Yeah.
It
was like, oh.
We've gone up the line. And it's funny for Christians to hear other people talk like that. We're just not used to it.
Yeah.
That last one, though, there's a problem. Why would I choose anything that isn't the best? Human nature and my own wisdom lead me to do that.
Well, that's the problem. In an inclusivist, they'd say the reason they're not choosing mine is just they don't know any better. They just don't know any better. So that there's that superiority.
Yeah, because it's still a nice way of saying they're stupid.
Right, it's a nice way of saying they're stupid. But it's a way of saying, well, maybe there's some hope for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it is sometimes a very nice way of saying they don't know any
uninformed.
Better. They're uninformed. All right. Yeah, uninformed might be better than stupid. Uninformed. Pluralism. All right, another response. Pluralism, where truth is not the exclusive or inclusive possession of any one tradition or community. The diversity of communities, traditions, understandings of truth, and visions of God is not an obstacle for us to overcome, but an opportunity. A pluralist might say, God is listening, but our God is not ours alone. In fact, God, the term, is just our way of speaking of a reality that cannot be encompassed by any one religious tradition, including our own. God is so big. Diana Eck says that she remembers in her small Methodist church in Montana, in the church library on the few shelves, she remembers a book that the title of which was, Your God is Too Small. And she remembers that in terms of that title kind of gripping her. What do you mean, your God is too small? So a pluralist is grappling with that idea of how big is God? What does that even mean?
Makes me think a little bit of the Native American religion and how much we can, you know, learn from some of what they've embraced, like the whole earth, the love mm-hmm. of the earth, and that kind of thing.
Definitely. God transcends our own idea of God. All right, our own is not the pinnacle, the epitome of definition. So God, whatever that might be, might be bigger than how we've come to think of God. Pluralists can be particularly Christian, or they can be Jewish or Hindu or whatever tradition is, while not expecting everyone else to be the same thing. All right. So pluralism allows for some particularity. Sometimes pluralism gets a bad rap, saying, well, then everybody's just equal, and we'll get on to that. And it allows for no particularity. Pluralism at its best does embrace that idea of particularity. I can be a Christian. I can affirm Christ. But that doesn't mean I have to turn the Hindu into an enemy.
This may be really naive, but I have a hard time seeing both of those at the same time. It seems like if you're really embracing pluralism, that all of those particular, you can't have both. How can you be believe in this larger being and then be a Lutheran in this box, you know.
It's one way of understanding this larger being. We're contextualized. We are not floating people in space. We don't have this sort of objective position. We have to grapple with God in a particular community and in particular ways, so which allows for those differences, whether it be Lutheran or Catholic or Muslim and, you know, Shia or, you know.
Right.
But what happens if you go into the Lutheran church and they start singing, "You're this," do you not join in? So how am I a Christian soldier?
I won't, actually. I won't. I won't sing it, and I won't let my kids do it.
Okay.
So, you know, and everybody's got to come to their own thing, but I don't, and I've decided that. And I actually, it took me a long time, and I realized there are some things I won't say in the context of a worship service, you know, in terms of when I see things like that come. Because before I thought, well, I'm here, I just have to do everything they're doing. But I realized, I'm a thinking person, I need to figure out where I am in that.
Yeah, I was a practicing Catholic for most of my life, and we called that maybe
a cafeteria Catholic. So whether you can pick and choose, a cafeteria Catholic.
Can you say what the words were that you don't say?
Oh, honor Christian soldiers, like when they're singing that. She said, you say that? And then there are other things that come up. You know, if I say, no, this is a problem for me. Back there, yeah.
I think part of that, though, is goes back to that context thing. The Lutheran Church says we believe in all three creeds, including the
Nicene,
Athanasian, the freaky Athanasian one.
Right.
I don't believe in what that says anymore, even though when I was ordained, I said I did. But the point is, I understand why they said it back then. I understand why it's part of our tradition. Mm-hmm. It made sense 1,500 years ago. So I can accept something, I can look at it in its context and say, I understand why it's part of our tradition, even though now our tradition has grown out of it.
Right.
Because also 1,500 years ago, women weren't ordained.
Right.
So I'm not going to say the church is bad because 1,500 years ago they were wrong. At least that's how I can deal with things I don't agree with now, is putting them in their context.
I lead a worship service in a nursing home, and they often will request, "I'm a Christian soldier." Well, do I say that's a bad hymn, we aren't going to sing it? I sing "Marching On to Peace," and I play "Marching On to Peace," and they can do what they want with it.
Well, and then you're in a different setting in terms of context. It's everything. Why are they singing it? Are you training up faithful individuals at that point? A lot of times in a nursing home setting, especially in places where people are very deeply affected by things like Alzheimer's or dementia, some of those things from your youth come back, and those are the memories that you have. In that case, it's almost more of a health issue. If you've got a memory, who am I to take it away from you?
Right.
But and they're not; these people aren't going to be marching anywhere.
No.
You know.
What she said really struck a nerve, mm-hmm. because that's one of the problems I've had. I grew up in a Protestant faith, and I've been exposed to all of these different religions, and I find so much good and so much that. You know, I think it was your session earlier this week, and you have students that say, "How can I call myself a Christian?" Mm-hmm. Because in whatever box or whatever sense that Christianity is defined, my understanding and my belief is just larger than that.
Going back to this idea of cafeteria Catholics, that it's almost cafeteria Christians, cafeteria, you know. Religious shoppers?
It's not a positive
thing. No, it's not. But partly because the sense is, depending on who's saying it, you need to accept it all or accept nothing. It's an all or nothing approach. And I think in the world in which we live in today, it doesn't recognize the realities that Catholic Christianity is incredibly diverse. If you take one Catholic community and strand of thought, it will look very different. Like, I know worker nuns in New York City, who are activists, and then you put them with a parish priest in northern Minnesota, they are different. They are both as Catholic can be, but they are different. And their beliefs are different. And they embrace Catholicism. Would you call them cafeteria Catholics? No, they're picking up on different strands in their traditions. Our traditions are very, very rich and diverse. That sense that we have to accept, and when they say cafeteria, you say, whose package are you talking about? Whose package?
Another is some clergy in here, and I wonder if any of them have had experience as a military chaplaincy or maybe a hospital chaplaincy where you've got to do the pluralism thing as part of your professional responsibility, and whether that's anything that can be commented on.
Anybody here? I do know of a case, and there's a new film out. It was, I think, a year ago, came out by the author of, has anybody heard of the book Constantine's Sword?
Yep.
By James Carroll? He produced a film based on that book, and it's a really powerful film. But the context of that film is taking a look at the Air Force Academy, and that's in Colorado Springs, I believe. Am I correct on that? And there was a big instance there where the local, very evangelical church had very much impacted the academy, and as well as the academy itself was very evangelical, to the point that they were very hostile and often cruel, physically and otherwise, to members of other religious traditions. And so that there was a very active proselytizing thing, and there was legal cases against this, but it took a while to come to earth. But I know that in the military it has been a problem, especially in the last decade, since really the first Gulf War, but especially heading into the last decade, where you've had a real push in evangelical circles to provide chaplains for the military, whereas others are tending less, the main lines are tending less toward that sort of ministry. So there has been a real conflict there.
Well, I guess my question was more about, here you are as a military chaplain. You may come out of the Jewish tradition, Catholic tradition, any one of a number of varieties of Protestant. But your responsibility in that situation is to tend to the spiritual needs of everybody, of whatever sort
and that,
of tradition
and that's
they
true.
Come from. And how do you balance this sense of who you are against what you're supposed to be, what you're called to do, I guess maybe a broader idea than what you had when you first got into the clergy situation.
So in many ways, you are having to live the life of a pluralist.
Yes.
Yeah.
And almost you by choice of getting into that, and that's been the issue where you've had this push for exclusivism, and the backlash that's created.
I know well an Arab-Palestinian Catholic priest, Melkite Catholic. And he says, our God is so great and so big that it takes all of these different traditions to even begin to explain God. And I think that's a beautiful way of accepting and putting it all together, sort of facets of a gem.
And the question about the chaplain, it would seem to me that no matter what, you have an obligation to respond to a person and not impose yourself and your beliefs. But the compassionate thing is to say, this person has this need, and my obligation is to fulfill it.
I think in that instance, I think the motto is almost, and the ideal and the guideline is humanity before ideology. You deal with a person as a human being rather than as a set of beliefs or practices.
As thinking world citizens, I think it's intellectually easy to embrace pluralism of the three that we see. Mm-hmm. But as Lutherans, which I'm not, or as Christians, which I might be, what does the Bible teach primarily on those three, exclusivism, inclusion, or pluralism?
What I talk to my students, and that's the trick question, isn't it? You know? What I talk to my students in classes about is that the Bible was composed over a very long period of time in many different contexts by hundreds of different people, all of whom had different perspectives. What you can find in the biblical texts are all three. Unfortunately, the Bible never speaks with a unified voice. The only thing unified in the biblical text is that God created, and we are God's creations. What God created, God believed was good. After that, it all falls apart. Really. Beyond that sort of thing. And so I think that the Bible does, and all the sacred texts of many traditions do have these different strands. Islam has a very powerful pluralistic strand. People don't necessarily know it, but those are present and available.
I grew up in a family. My father was a
direct. He was in the ecumenical movement that was very big in the 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. and 70s, and I grew out of that tradition in terms of my faith. So I see a lot of this is just sort of, yeah, totally agree. Where, how does this relate to the ecumenical movement? Because I know that that also started to plummet in terms of its popularity. It seems like
inter-Christian, yeah, you know.
Not even just Christian. It was all sorts of traditions.
Actually, the that term has come less into use. The idea of interreligious dialogue and religious pluralism have in some ways replaced that in terms of terminology. They're trying to describe the same thing. That's what I'm saying. There's been a real kind of shift in terminology as people are really trying to grapple with this idea. So ecumenism hasn't disappeared, all right? But the terms have changed. But it was a term primarily defined by Christians. Ecumene, Greek community, New Testament. So it was kind of a stepping back from that. Can we use other terms to describe what we do that aren't imposing already our ideas on it? So yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but people have just tended to get away from that. And often the way that's used now is within particular circles, within like Lutheran Catholic dialogue, which has been ongoing and kind of working out different things. Often that is described as ecumenical. But the term has lost a little bit of playtime.
Two comments. One, it seems to me a general description of many of these issues is folks just take metaphors literally.
Mm-hmm.
With Onward Christian Soldiers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Paul talks about putting on the breastplate of righteousness. Mm-hmm. This is all imagery to try to convey a concept.
A concept, right.
And then my other comment is I started to think about this whole thing in terms of a progression from tolerance to acceptance to affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
And if you end up at that point of affirmation, I don't know how you avoid saying, well, it doesn't matter what you believe.
Exactly.
Why don't you affirm something and get on with your life?
Relativism. And that's what it's called. And that's where we're going to get there in just a second. Yep.
Because the next thing you come to is acceptance of atheism.
It's a religion.
No, but aren't we called to spread the word?
No.
The gospel?
I'm not called to spread the Hindu gospel, using the word.
I'm
not.
So I'm going to spread the Christian gospel.
That's what you're called to do.
Okay.
But in
that
calling, there's room for that.
Okay.
Remember, mutual witness. I bear witness. Someone can bear witness to me. In that process, we both might learn something and change. And that's what pluralism is not. All right, let's go. It's not simply diversity and the existence of difference. It's not just different groups, you know, all standing side by side or living side by side. It's actually, the term pluralism, as it's often being used and as Eck uses it in the Harvard Pluralism Project, the idea is active engagement with the other to understand both commonality and difference. It's not just the existence of different, it is engagement. So there's action involved in pluralism. It is not just, it is not an adjective. Maybe I should describe it that way. It's not a simple describing.
It's a verb.
Yeah, it's a verb. Right, it's got an action component, like the action verb that kids learn about, the action words. It is not simply tolerance. Well, let them be, it all be, and you know, that sort of thing. Tolerance can allow coexistence. It can keep people alive. So sometimes tolerance isn't so bad, all right? But it doesn't make for good neighbors or meaningful relationships. If I let the people down the street live, they let me live, we don't interact, we never get to know each other, it's not as if we're watching out for each other. You know, there could be a fence post down the street with the same meaning, okay?
And our hardest job is to be able to be pluralistic with someone who's intolerant.
Yes. Yes, exactly. So pluralism seeks understanding and applies a willingness to be challenged and changed. Last one, and I think this is where everybody's sort of been, this is where we all get kind of anxious, relativism. So if everybody's the same, if all paths are equal, then why bother being anything? Is one, and my students say that. Well, then none of it matters. And I think that's taking too many leaps. Simple relativism means that every tradition is equally and equally uncompelling. All is gray. relativism in the construct of pluralism is relativism with commitment. You have commitment to a particular tradition or stance or perspective. All right, they're not done away with. They're embraced. It's a paradox. So maybe this whole pluralism thing is very Pauline. This and that at the same time. That sense that I can maintain, just like we were talking, my particular religious commitment. I know that Jesus has done something for me, a Christian can say. I have had an experience of Jesus and I want to tell you about it. Somebody who's Hindu can say, I have had an experience of the divine and I want to tell you about it. My experience of Jesus does not nullify your experience of the divine. Can those two, and I think that's part of the thing, it is, and actually pluralism can embrace profound commitment. Profound commitment.
John Dominic Crossan deals with this by talking about human relationships. He says, you know, do you believe that your spouse is the only person in the world you could be married to? Mm-hmm. And most people say, no, there's probably other people out there.
They don't say that to their spouse.
They don't say
that's exactly the point, because there's a particular, I would argue that my wife is the best wife in the world.
Right.
And most other men, you would argue that too. But it doesn't mean we have to fight each other. It's a particular. That's my spouse is particular to me.
To you.
And so she is the most amazing woman in the world. And you would argue that about your spouse. It doesn't mean that, you know.
Your spouse doesn't have to be everybody's spouse.
Hopefully not.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Around my head for a number of minutes now was by a Chilean biologist named Humberto Maturana, and he's working on a cellular biology level and started to discover the attractive properties of cells, and his work really grew into what is the nature of love. And one of the things he said that's been a really riveting quote for me for many years is that any claim of truth is a demand for obedience, which is a very pluralistic perspective. And I'm wondering if the wicked problem in all of this is then what do we do with the concept of truth? Is there a truth?
That's the question. Is there a truth?
Right.
In the very Greek tradition that Christianity is steeped in, as well as some of the other, particularly Western traditions, there's the idea of one truth. You can only have one.
So it's a mental model.
It's a mental model. But if you take a look at Judaism, the entire Talmud, their entire sacred literature is comprised of complex arguments in which many truths can be affirmed at the same time. Who says there has to be one? That's the construct, and we've all adopted it and assimilated it, and then we apply it to everything else. Yes?
One of my biggest problems is someone who says to me, do you believe in God? Because I know they want me to endorse their God.
Right.
Well, I heard the right answer. This theologian was asked this question. He responded by, which one? Do you believe in God? He said, which one?
There may indeed be one truth.
There may, but we don't know it.
But as a guy who spent most of his life in science, I know that I'm not going to get there by any tool that I can possibly imagine. And I'm pretty sure on the spiritual side of things, I ain't going to get there that way either. So what I have to deal with is a contingent truth. And it may not be the same for the next person who I happen to be married with.
Paul Tillich, the theologian, has said that, yes, there may be one truth. Do I know it? No. You know, that sense that I can grasp it entirely. He said, I might have a piece of it.
Yeah, did you have your hand?
What I want to take a look at is close in the last just 3 minutes here. How then should we live in this great house that we have inherited? How can we expand our definition of we so that we don't always need to speak in terms of us and them? Because if you're in a family and it's an us and them, it's not a happy family. It's a very difficult household. How can we become the operating word? How can we all thrive in our home rather than simply coexist or maybe survive? I've talked to a lot of people lately with teenage kids, and it seems that coexistence seems to be, but that isn't the objective. People hope for more. You know, thriving requires more than coexistence. How can we make the space, both literally and figuratively, when we build this house and we add on to this house, for everyone to fit, to everybody have the space? Right? How can we make our home a better place? All right. A lot of times, who does the repairs? How do we repair it? How can we make it a better home for all of us to live in? What can we do to be a happier family, a more contented family, a serving family? These are some questions I leave you to think about. These are the questions that we need to answer in our communities. And I also like to close with a quote by a Hindu named Radha Krishnan, and who spoke of the ferment of restlessness. Petar Jothan earlier this week spoke about restlessness in his sermon, but this restlessness created by modernity. He said, "The world has found itself as one body," he said, "but physical unity and economic interdependence are not by themselves sufficient to create a universal human community. The cause of the present tension and disorder is the lack of adjustment between the process of life, which is one of increasing interdependence, and the ideology of life, the integrating habits of mind, loyalties, and affections embodied in our laws and institutions. The supreme task of our generation is to give a soul to the growing world consciousness." What I think this boils down to is that as a world, we are interrelated, interconnected, whether it's economically, socially, ideas, culture, but there's a lot of this exchange. We're already doing it, but we've kind of got a disconnect when it comes to what we think, what we believe, our ideologies. We're not interconnected there yet. So we're saying, well, we'll be interrelated or interconnected here, but not here. And when you do that, you create tension. How do we grasp this interrelatedness and realize that it impacts all spheres of our life, not just our wallets, not just our popular music, but how we view the world in which we live? Those ideologies are the things we tend to hold on to most tenaciously and not want to have anyone else interfere with. Thank you very much.
Thank you.